So just skipping ahead in your life, you went to university and then I understand you came back here to Wollongong, is that correct?
Yes, I did. Well,
so what?
I went to university to do economics and law.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really want to do that. I initially enrolled in French, German and English. But I came second in the state in economics.
Mm-hmm.
And I met my economics teacher in the street one day, and he said to me, oh, you should be starting uni soon. And I said, in a week. And he said, when you meet so-and-so in the economics faculty, blah, blah, blah. I said, I won't be in the economics faculty. He said, what? What are you doing? I said, I'm doing French, German and English. Well, he said, oh, no. He said, I forbid it.
And you listened.
So I went and changed my enrolment.
Right.
You know what? I have to say this, that economics was the most useful subject I ever studied at university. I left in the middle of third year. I waited till I got my scholarship, Commonwealth Scholarship Allowance, which I took to David Jones and got the cheque made to cash. And I said, can you give me all single pound notes? And when I got back to the hostel, I got the pound notes and I threw them up in the air like that. And they all fell down and floated and I scrambled around and I got going, yeah! And then I got another lot. Well, I was very disappointed. And when I got all the money up and I gathered it up, I went back to David Jones and I bought my mother a beautiful dress, a navy dress with white polka dots and polka dotted shoes too that happened to be around. So I got her that and I used to always like to, you know, make her happy in some way. And so I went back and I gave her that. I did it because I felt free. You know, I felt free and I thought, I don't give a fuck about money. And
but that was your living allowance, wasn't it? So what were you going to live on?
I've got to be honest. I did arrange to get a cadetship. I was employed as a graduate cadet at the Telegraph. And I hadn't told my mum and dad I was going there. They were very disappointed.
So you hadn't finished your degree?
No.
Nice.
I was in the middle of third year, so I had done six subjects. And one of which was logic, which was incredibly useful. Another was commercial law, that was less useful. So I went to work at the Telegraph, and I was there for 9 months, and it was incredibly boring because it was finance cadet.
So what made you leave university to do that?
To do that?
Yeah.
Because I did want to be a journalist. I was intending to become a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason that I left the university in economics was that economics was so boring because I didn't know at the time. Have you ever heard of Ted Wheelwright?
I have heard that name, yes.
Well, he was famous. He became a famous professor of economics. He was leftish. He was English. And at the time, I didn't know that he was at Sydney University Economics Department as a tutor. Well, he eventually got a personal chair. I mean, it was created for him to be Professor of Political Economy. And it was political economy that I had been interested in. That's what we had studied at school, political economy. Well, what I was studying at Sydney was econometrics, which was largely mathematical and accounting. National accounts and stuff like that. God. And the lectures were boring. They were like clerks, bank clerks or something. And I thought, oh, God, you know. And you couldn't... I didn't even know that a tutorial was something smaller than a lecture because the tutorials were always had a couple hundred people in them. And so they just gave you a lecture. It wasn't until I came to Wollongong Uni that I discovered the lectures... The tutorials were small and they're like teaching.
So you left to become, because the economics was boring.
And so I went to work at the Telegraph. That was kind of boring too, because in the morning we had to get all the share prices from the stock exchange, came in a teleticker machine, and then in the afternoon, 2 o'clock, the two reporters and I, we went down to the stock exchange and sat at the press table, and we copied down all the shares from the board. And if you didn't get the very last share of the day, you were for it. Mm. And sometimes somebody used to come and sell a share just, you know, maybe in an odd minute, and if you didn't pick it up. Well, anyway, I thought, I can't stay here forever, this is terrible. So I went three times, I went for an interview to the ABC, because the ABC was famous for not paying but giving you terrific training. And so the first time the job was up in Durham, and they said, oh no, we're not looking for a girl, because, you know. And I said, but don't tell me there aren't any girls in Darwin, surely. And they said, no. So then later on in the year they advertised again, and I applied for it. This was for general news down. And so they did tell me then, I had to go for three interviews. Three. All men interview me. The last one, they said to me, what would you do if the president of the ACTU, who happened to be Bob Pock at the time, what would you do if the president of the ACTU offers you a good story in exchange for your sleeping with them? I said, well, I don't go in for martyrdom. I said, I'm afraid you wouldn't be able to count on me to sacrifice my virtue for the ABC. I certainly wouldn't consider doing that. I said, but I have grown up in Glasgow, and I think I know how you deal with union people. So that was that. And they told me I would have to go back to university and finish my economics degree. Mm-hmm. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And you mustn't get married. I said, well, I will if I feel like it. Then that afternoon, I rang the ABC because I got chatting to the receptionist there. She and I, we had a few little chats together. And I said to her, have you heard anything yet? She said, you've got it. Mm-hmm. Oh, I said, oh, God. Well, anyway, I was so thrilled. And then I became utterly downcast, because I was depressed about not having enough money. They only paid £7 as opposed to 11. The matron at the hostel said that because I was going to be working three shifts, that I couldn't stay at the hostel anymore, because it wouldn't be good to having people coming in and out all hours of the day and night. And then they told me that I would be in Sydney for 3 weeks, and then they would take me to Canberra to teach me to become a political journalist. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, that was, you know, a fantastic offer. Well, I had my mind on Fleet Street, but I would go to the ABC first. And, well, anyway, to cut a long story short, I changed my mind. I got very depressed. If I had gone home and spoke to my parents, they'd have cheered me up and said, you know, don't worry about the money, you'll manage, or we'll try and get you some. But I didn't, and I've got to... I packed my bag. I wrote to the ABC, said, change my mind. I packed my bags. I had £25 I got from the Telegraph, you know, you're finishing up pay, £25. And I went up to Brisbane. I would have gone to Perth or someplace, but they didn't have any trains going that far. So I went up to Brisbane. I was so depressed. I got talking to there was a girl sitting beside me who was a nurse going to save her uncle. She ended up taking me to their place. And then the next morning, she took me to a big hostel for 2,000 people. Mm-hmm. There were gold miners and all kinds of people, and it was amazing. And I was sharing a room with a 72-year-old woman who was never conscious.
And what was your plan? Why were you going to Brisbane?
Why did I go to Brisbane? Oh, I just wanted to run away.
Just to get away.
Yeah, because I was I just felt I felt so depressed. And then, guess what? I got my periods. And of course, whenever I get my PVs, I go, you know, I always do something irrational. And I thought, oh God, not them. And that's what it was.
Making you feel so bad.
Yeah, making you feel you can't function.
Yes,
yeah.
So what did you do?
I went to the Courier Mail and asked if they had a job, and she said, and I started crying when I was there, and she said, darling, don't worry about it. Everybody at your age feels like that when we're starting off. She said, we'll probably have a cadetship in May. So I went and got a job with an advertising agency, and then I got chatting to a Polish chap who took me on the Brisbane River, and then I wrote to my mother and told her what I'd done, and then the next day there was a message from the reception saying, will Mary Rose Lavery please come to the reception desk? I went there, my mum was there. She said, come on, you're coming back.
Back to Wollongong?
Yeah, back to Wollongong and back to the library.
Okay. And they gave you another job here?
Yeah. Oh, no worries.
Same man?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's Mr. Murray.
Okay.
And, and he said, oh, have you come back? And I said, yeah, but I haven't got my degree and all that stuff. Yes, so it was when I came back and started working there that I met a girl that I'd been very friendly with, a woman, before. She said to me, come and let's have a coffee. And that was how I met my husband. Yeah, we went into the coffee lounge. And she and I were chatting. And she said, oh, look who's here. She said, love it, Annie, come here. And he came over and she said, let me introduce you to the most dangerous Italian in Wollongong. And he shook him. Well, anyway.
At first sight.
It was love at first sight. Yeah. Except I didn't know that.
Didn't you?
No, I didn't really know it. I was kind of, he was talking to her because they knew a lot of people.
Yes.
And they were catching up. He was sitting facing her and I was sitting at the side of him, facing her too. Mm. But I was watching him out the corner of my eye, and I really, what impressed me was that I thought I had seen his face on medallions, ancient faces, very romantic, completely un-Australian, very romantic, thousands of years old, so I was thinking. Yeah, so his face really fascinated me, and he had a very nice speaking voice too. His English was good.
Mm.
And anyway, after about half an hour or something, he suddenly turned around like that and he said to me, well, you've been observing me closely for the last half hour. What do you think? As a result of that, that afternoon, I was working in the afternoon shift at the library. At 5 o'clock, somebody gave me a ring and said, you know, there's somebody down here wants to talk to you, it's got a message or something. And I went down and it was him. I said, yes. He said, I was wondering, since you didn't have any lunch today, if you'd like to come have dinner tonight. Oh, I said, I don't finish here till 9 o'clock. He said, all we Italians eat late. Yeah.
Okay.
So we had dinner. I think we saw each other just about every day after that, and we got married about 4 weeks later.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was quite a lot older than you.
Yeah, I was 20 and he was 38. But he never ever struck me as being older.
So you met him when you were working at the library. How long did you work at the library
after that time?
Yeah, that second time. Oh, so from when you were 20.
Well, he said I couldn't work at the library anymore after we got married.
Who said that? Your husband?
My husband said, yeah. We got an envelope and wrote down all the things about when we got married, right? Mm. And he said, no working at the library. I said, what? No, of course I'm going to work at the library. No. He said, first you have to work at your marriage. When I applied for the job in 1976, I was interviewed by a man who had been the librarian but was leaving to go back to a commune he had been a hippie. And he had spent the previous year doing nothing but ordering books because the Whitlam government, this must have been about 72 actually, when Britain, when Whitlam got in, the Whitlam government had gotten in and spent and given all this money to libraries, not for labour, only for books. And so he had spent the whole year making orders for books. And he was leaving to go back to his commune, and he was now, the new librarian was someone who'd been a principal librarian at the National Library. Now, I didn't know this at the time, but he was one, his father, I think, was one of about seven kids who were all, I don't know what tribe, but they were American Indians. He was a very good-looking guy.
And what was his name? Do you remember his
name? All I remember from what he said to me was, you'll have to get a Commonwealth Medical, you know, Commonwealth Medical exam. Yeah. And I said, what? What, are you giving me the job? Are you giving me the job? He said, no, I didn't say that. I said, well, I'm not getting an exam, medical exam, if I'm not getting the job. That would be a waste. Oh, and the other chap, he told them about the winter sparrows, you see. And he did ask me a few questions about that. And he did ask me some questions about what I'd done in economics and stuff like that. And so I got the job. The girl who had been sitting beside me, I think I saw her when I came out, that she was waiting to be interviewed. And I knew that she would probably not understand why they could have given me the job, because she was a cataloguer and I had been doing God knows what, putting books in order, I think. She would never have been able to figure.
And why do you think it was because you'd written the book?
No. I think that it might have been the kind of book that I'd written.
Yes.
I think it showed it was pretty tough. The library at that time, it got 1, 2, 3... department heads knew. One was a woman from South Africa and the other came from Sydney. She was pretty smart. So there were three new people. Well, you know, at the time I was 37, so I was the right age. And I have to say, I'd had a bit of experience also teaching in a tough school. Mm-hmm. Mm. Where, you know, the kids did pretty well, actually. I got control of them and... Yeah. All that stuff. And so when it came to actually going into tech services, actually I interviewed them all as I would as a journalist. And so I interviewed and I got them talking about the library and the department and what changes they'd like to see and what they did in their spare time and all that stuff. And then the next time I went round and I sat beside everyone at the desk and said, show me what you do. Well, you learned an enormous amount. I mean, I knew nothing.
Yes. So this was all before you got the job?
Oh, no, I got the job.
You got the job.
And I went in.
Then you worked out how to do it.
How to do it. And you know what? Economics was everything. Economics was everything. Economics told me how to do it. There were books everywhere. I have to say, it was completely disorganised, largely because there was no power. The power was in the wrong places in the library. Yeah. The power was with people who had no nominal authority. Mm-hmm. The cataloguers just were like this. They're a bit like the Sicilians, come si vuoi, signora, you know. I interviewed them all. I went round all the things and I worked out, well, for instance, half some of the books, to type out the cards... The number of cards being typed out every day was peanuts. And it was because they had a great big old machine. It was incredible. And only one person on the staff could use it. And he could only spend half a day a week on it. I said, oh, come on. Anyway, I said to him, you better train everybody, including me. And we're going to have a whole day's work on those cards. And then suddenly thought, maybe they've invented something a bit more advanced since those days. So I discovered that you could get a wee machine that would sit. It would sit on the desk. It took you 2 minutes to learn. You didn't have to clean it all up, and you could get 100 cards in, you know, 10 minutes. Well, that got all the cards moving. So you moved along the age, you know. And then there was the other thing. Why are these books all here? What's holding them up? Oh, well, so-and-so can't come in to do the painting of the initials on the spine, the call numbers on the spine, because she has a fight with him, who did nothing, and he told her to get out. I said, right, now, what, I said, that, you should be able to type the letters and on a wee labels and put them on. Oh, but you wouldn't be able to see them. I said, have you tried it? So I made them get, I went up and got golf balls to put in the typewriter. And then they typed out some, and we put them on and we compared them with the thingy. They really can't see it.
So you revolutionised the place.
Well, that was it. I revolutionised it on a production thing. And I said to them, now, you're all stuck on one job, right? I said, but your jobs are only semi-skilled. You shouldn't be stuck in one job. Everybody here should be able to do the job of everybody else except the cataloguers. And so I want you to work for 1.5 hours at one thing, because after that your marginal productivity will start to go down. And so that was what they had to do. Well, now, there was a girl I noticed that she didn't see me being around all the time. So I went and I said, what's... Oh, she's probably in another department talking to her friends. Oh, yeah. So I went to look for this girl. I got her. And I said, I'm a rate payer here. I said, I don't like paying my rates to you. I said, so you get back in there and get on your work. And then I caught her at it again. She was not again. And I really gave her a telling off, and she started weeping, you know. And I said, Dad, here, I'm not interested in your tears. Go on, get back in. And she said, you're a Nazi. I said, yes, I am, and I'm not ashamed of it. And, you know. Well, but the funniest thing that happened was that one day I came in the bus, I looked out the window, and I saw her with her boyfriend. It was a Maori, big chap. And I looked at my watch, it was about 9:10, so I thought, oh, she's probably working on Flixie time. Well, I just saw them, they were, you know, cuddling and all that, and got into the library, and the phone rang, and it was her. And she said, I won't be able to come into work today because I'm not feeling well. I said, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Where do you live, actually? She said, Dapto. I said, oh, really? I said, well, you must have flown there. Because I just happened to see you about 5 minutes ago up with your loving boyfriend, and you looked pretty fit to me. She said, oh, well, I suppose I'd better come in then. And I said, no, you can stay home, you might as well get something out of it, because you're feeling very humiliated, I imagine. So the next day she came in, and I never ever said a word about it. And from then on, she was as good as gold. Mm. She actually turned out to be one of the brightest girls on the staff. Then her computers were coming in, and she did a lot. Mm. But the big fellow, the one who told the other girl to get out, I called him in. And I said, now we're going to, there's going to be a lot of audiovisual stuff. And, I'm going to put you in with the cataloguers, and you can do descriptive cataloguing. Mm-hmm. You've been there 50. I said, how long have you been here? He said, 15 years. And then he said, no, I don't want to get into descriptive cataloguing. And I said, well, you got no choice. I said, you have sit in that area over there, and you've been ruling the roost, and you are no longer in that happy situation. Now, you've got a choice. You can go there, or you can get the sack. I had gone up to speak to Richard Drake before that and said, what about if I have to get rid of somebody? Go ahead, he said. Right. And I said to him, now, he said, I said, why do you want to stay there anyway? He said, because I was told when I was on holiday and I came back, they put me in there, and they said that that was the only way I could become a professional librarian. I said, oh, really? No. I said, the way you become a professional librarian is by doing your exams. Mm-hmm. And, I forgot to mention, they had done all the papers at the college. I did five in 1 year and four in the other.
Oh, you knocked that over.
Yeah. And yeah, I forgot about that, actually.
In between everything else.
And he said, and I said to him, and you've spent all, instead of studying, I said, you've spent all your time playing golf for the weekend. Because he told me that was his hobby. So I said, yeah, well, you've got 5 minutes to think about it. He said, all right. Well, he turned out to be able to do three times the work of other people. Mm. Yeah.
So you really got the best out of people.
I did.
From shaking the place up a bit.
I shook them up. Mm. I definitely did.
Mm. And how long were you...
3 years. Yeah, because by the end of the first year, we'd got rid of all the books.
Okay.
We had got rid of all the books. Oh, yes. And I said, we've got to get rid of them because we're shifting and everybody else... we'll have to carry the books, but we won't have to because we've finished. Big, oh, the laugh was on me. We were finished, so right, okay, tech services, you go there and take all the reference books in. So
what made you leave in the end?
Boredom.
Oh, really? And then back to journalism?
No, I got a job as Commonwealth Film Censor. Back to journalism while I was a censor, because I did features for the Herald. And a television column. So I just went drifted back into it after I finished at the censorship board.
Mm-hmm. And you still lived in this area then?
Yeah, I was commuting. I was commuting.
Okay. And what did your husband do? What was his...
He was a site manager for Transfield when I met him.
Oh, right.
And he was in charge of about 300 men. That was how I got to know about Transfield men. And I met the founders. And I started doing the interviews and all of that.
Yes.
Right.
And you had a long and happy marriage, I
understand. Yes, we did. But I have to say that he was, he was empathetic.
Mm-hmm.
He was empathetic. And once in Florence, I was coming home on the bus from a job where I was working, and the Italian soldiers were sitting, and they never get up to give you a seat, and I felt really pissed off. And... I sometimes get this feeling that I'm entirely alone in the universe. I'm just a little star up in the sky. There's nothing else up there, just me twinkling. And it's quite lonely. So when I came home from the bus, I was feeling like that. And I came into the flat we were living in, and my husband was doing something, and he looked at me and he said, "What's the matter with you?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Come on, tell me what it is." I said, nothing. Go on, what is it? So then I started sobbing. And he always used to put his arms on like me, like this, you know. And I filmed me in it, and he said, "What is it?" And I said, "I feel so alone. I feel so alone in the universe." And he said, "We all feel like that, but we have to survive." And I was stunned because I didn't know other people felt like that. I said, yes, you're right, we have to survive. And that cheered me up immediately. And then he said, "Get the girls and we'll go out for dinner."
Lovely.
Yeah. But, you know, he could feel things. Mm. Were going on in your head without you telling him.
Mm.
And when I did tell him things, he always listened carefully. A lot of men don't, you know. A lot of men don't. A lot of men don't even catch on to what their wives are trying to tell them. But he wasn't like that. Mm. He understood me. I was very happy. I used to come home from work and think, God, even the Queen's not like me.
How lovely.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a fascinating chat, Mary Rose.
I have to say, it's been a very indulgent one for me. God, blabbing, blabbing,
no.
blabbing, blabbing.
It's been really interesting. After reading your Winter Sparrows, it's just been lovely to meet you because you have such a turn of phrase and such a passionate way of looking at life. It's wonderful. So I look forward to your next book.